Okay, joining us today is Marty Nemko, a career counselor out of the San Francisco area and an advisor to over 15 different college presidents throughout the United States. Marty Nemko, welcome to Radio Free Penn State here on Penn State Student Radio, The Line, 90.7 FM. How are you?
I am fine. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for joining us today. I'm Andy, your friendly neighborhood annihilator, and joining me today is Mr. John Dandrea. And it's our pleasure to speak to you today. And the reason we're talking today is because you have, as I understand, a book coming out. Is that right?
No, I don't have a book coming out. I've written six books, including the All-in-One College Guide, which focuses heavily on how to make the most of a big place like Penn State. But I had an article that came out recently that was pretty critical of higher education called America's Most Overrated Product, the Bachelor's Degree, which appeared in the Chronicle of Higher Education.
That's right. That's right. I am pulling up that article as we speak. In that article, you outlined many of, I guess, the pitfalls of today's modern-day higher education conundrum, if you will. You talked about the cost, the rising cost of higher education as it exists today, and what many students are getting in return for that very high cost of attending
everybody
college.
Everybody knows about the cost, but they don't realize, and I'm sure, you know, it's pretty frightening, the amount of freshman to senior growth. According to a Pew Charitable Trust study in 2006, the average growth from freshman to senior in reading skills, thinking skills, math reasoning skills, it's frighteningly low. For example, would you believe that 50% of college seniors scored at what's called below the proficient level, which means they couldn't understand a newspaper editorial. They couldn't compare credit card offers. It's pretty frightening given the amount of money you're spending on that Penn State education.
Right, and you talked about that here in your column. As I understand, it appeared in the Chronicle of Higher Education. Very well-written piece, America's Most Overrated Product, the Bachelor's Degree. It seems as though that this isn't anything new, at least not for some. Some of the concerns and complaints that people have levied against bachelor's degrees, particularly liberal arts degrees, have been going on for decades.
Worse.
What's new or different now?
There was a recent study called the Spellings Commission Report that was a report to Congress that found that actually the amount of low achievement in, you know, low progress has declined further and is declining further in the last decade. And one of the major reasons is colleges have been under great pressure to admit ever more students. Now, not the main campus of Penn State, but at probably a lot of the satellite campuses of Penn State and a lot of the other public institutions, and certainly the very desperate for money private institutions, and Pennsylvania's got a million of them, you know, the Moravian colleges of the world, they are taking in students who are incredibly weak. So in the same class, you've got a very qualified student and a very, very underqualified student, and the professor is really has a hell of a time trying to meet the needs of that enormous range of kids in the same class. That's a major contributor to the decline in the amount of learning and growth that occurs as a result of going to college. At the same time, as colleges are increasing tuition and fees and housing way above the cost of inflation.
I believe you also mentioned somewhere in your column that one of the other things that many colleges have to deal with is that they're spending more time after admitting so many people, simply spending time on remedial programs.
Well, no question. I mean, they're admitting students who are really, you know, not even literate. It's so unfair. What goes on? I mean, I'm a little nervous about this sounding a little like hype, but I believe it in my soul. You know, I don't know if you've taken any ethnic studies class or whatever, but the Tuskegee experiments were very famous experiments in which African Americans were given some medical treatment, or they were given syphilis, and they were trying out different drugs. Anyway, a lot of them died without any disclosure to those people of the risks. Well, in many ways, what college is doing to the hundreds of thousands of underprepared students that they admit every year, disproportionately black and brown, because they want to appear open, they want to be diverse, they are not telling them that this frightening statistic that comes out of the U.S. Department of Education, that among college freshmen who graduated in the bottom 40% of their high school class, only one-third ever graduate, even if given 8.5 years, and they instead graduate with a mountain of debt, assaulted self-esteem, and remarkably little growth in reading, writing, etc. And even if they defy the odds and graduate, because these students who were weak in high school are normally kind of at the bottom of the graduating college class, mm-hmm. they do not do very well in the job market. And yet we don't disclose it to those kids, and yet we take their money. It is an out-and-out travesty.
So in your opinion, would it be fair to say that many people, that society has essentially sold one generation of young people after another a bill of goods, that college is their only ticket to success? Is would that be a fair assessment?
I would say it's it used to be true, and colleges used to be not far from off when they talked about, yeah, you'll do much better and you'll make a lot more money if you have a college degree. But that is increasingly untrue for the following reasons. Because we now accept a much higher proportion of college graduates to college. In that, this current crop is 68.2% of all high school graduates go on to college, versus only 40% in 1970. We've dug a lot deeper into the barrel. We've taken a lot weaker students to college. At the same time as now, in the most recent years and in moving forward, corporations are taking ever more of those college-requiring jobs and either offshoring them to India or China, mm-hmm. making them part-time, temp, automated, contract work, so that those increased number of weak students who are admitted to today's colleges are going to find it increasingly difficult to even make enough money to pay back their student loans, let alone be worth the time and money that they could have been spending had they, for example, done something more akin to their lack of academic orientation, like being in an apprenticeship program, mm-hmm. or being mentored at the side of a wise entrepreneur. They're certainly not learning a lot in terms of, you know, writing skills, thinking skills. The amount evaluated is just frighteningly low, and we don't even disclose that to those students, let alone doing what colleges really should do, was have the strength of character to say, you know, your chances of getting in are too low. You're 17 years old. You're not in a position to make this judgment. We are not admitting everybody to college. We're going to turn you down. And increasingly, colleges do not turn down weak students.
Do you think, let me back up a second. What do you think, in your opinion, is the role of college? What should higher education, quote unquote, really be about and really be for?
Well, there are different audiences. I think that certainly for the student, the perfect student to go on to college, ironically, is not a super self-starter. Very often a super self-starter, I know this guy named Ben Kuznoka who blogs these days, a young guy, graduated high school recently, and he decided he could learn much more in the real world. And so he has hooked himself up with all kinds of interesting people, frankly, including myself, where we're all mentors to this guy. We get together occasionally in person, we email constantly, we blog. He's also, he blogs, he gets feedback on all kinds of things from on all his ideas. He reads widely, he goes and he's thinking about starting a business. He's being mentored by business people. I guarantee you that this guy, without having spent a dime, is getting more of an education, both in terms of writing skills, thinking skills, career, networking, everything, than people who are going, for example, to Penn, who are paying $200,000 a year, for 4 years, and sitting through, as you well know, I'm sure you've sat through a lot of classes where you're saying, why in the world do I need to know this?
Right.
And stuff that you will forget as soon as the final is over, mainly because, A, you want to have fun in college, which I understand, go Nittany Lions, but also you're hoping that that piece of paper is going to be a ticket to a great career. And that is decreasingly, like it has been to some extent in the past, but colleges continue to perpetrate the myth that if you get a degree, you're going to do a lot better. They forget to mention that the pool of kids who go to college are brighter, more motivated, and better connected than the pool of kids who don't go. So you could have locked them in a closet for 4 years, and they're going to earn more money than the pool of non-college-bound people. And colleges are very good at statistics, unless it's going to hurt them. So then they kind of don't look at it, and they just report the misleading statistic that, oh, yes, college graduates make more.
All right. John, you have any questions?
Yes. Here at Penn State, I've spoken privately to more than one professor who has indicated that they're under a certain degree of pressure to, for lack of a better phrase, dumb down their courses.
Absolutely.
In order to to allow more students to be passed on.
Absolutely.
Because they're subject to evaluations, and those evaluations determine their salaries.
Absolutely. I was on the faculty at UC Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley, and at UC University of California, Davis, and at Cal State East Bay. That's a tremendous pressure. I'll tell you, two examples. One was when I was actually a professor in education and supervising student teachers, and I was supervising their field work. And I said to myself, once you certify a teacher, and after 2 years they get tenure, they have tenure for life. They will be either helping or hurting kids for years and years to come. So I said to myself as a student, I am not going to give a passing grade to any of my field work. These are people who are just about to get certified. This was their student teaching. I was not going to give a passing grade to anybody who I wouldn't want my daughter to be have as a teacher. So I actually failed 8 out of the 14 people. Guess what happened? I got fired for that.
Really?
My student evaluations were great. They loved me. Didn't matter. They wanted to push people through. There's a quiet, tacit agreement between the university and the parents who pay the money, etc., that, we won't bother you too much if you don't bother us too much. If you're terrible, we're going to have to give you low grades. But the amount of grade inflation, Steve Trachtenberg, who was the president of George Washington University, I believe, I may be wrong, I think he commandeered a study. The amount of grade inflation that's going on is enormous for reasons that you point out. Professors don't want to get low student evaluations, so they give great grades. The administrators put pressure on them because they don't want too much hassle. They don't want parents writing to the legislators saying, look at this, look what lousy educations you're providing and you're failing my students. So there's this tremendous pressure to push people forward, which is why when you look at the seniors who graduate from college, their writing skills, reading skills, thinking skills, according to a very definitive study by the Pew Trust in 2006, shows remarkably little value added. Professors care mainly about their research and their student evaluations. So they get tenure, they don't get fired, and they really will not hold the line and insist on excellence at all.
Yeah, we spoke about this a few days ago on our program, actually, because according to InsideHigherEd.com, there was a story that broke on May 14th in which a professor by the name of Stephen D. Aird lost his teaching biology job at Norfolk State University, which is a traditionally black college. And basically what happened there was that he claims in the article there was a quiet understanding, I guess unwritten, I suppose, by the deans stating that they must pass 70% of their students.
Let me tell you another little story. When I was teaching at Berkeley, I was teaching graduate, now catch this, this is a graduate class in evaluation of education, educational evaluation. I had one student, a Native American student, and on the there were like two papers and then a final exam. The two papers were done at home, and she did okay. She got B in both, and it was fine. The final was in class, and it was mainly essays. Her writing was incoherent. It was like I would expect my daughter when she was in the seventh grade to write better than that. So I failed her. I know that somebody else wrote her. The same person who wrote that final exam in class, unless she was sick and she said she was not, could never have written the same thing as those term papers that she did. So somebody wrote those term papers for her. So I fail her for the course. 2 days later, I get a phone call from the dean, a minority student affair dean or whatever, asking if I might somehow see my way to pass this woman. I said, if she's, and then the dean says, she's only one course away from getting her master's degree. I said, if this person was able to get a master's degree from the University of California at Berkeley with the writing and thinking skills she demonstrated there, that is an embarrassment to you and to everything that Berkeley does. I will not pass her. Guess what? Again, I wasn't a tenured professor. I was a lecturer where they can fire you at will. I was not rehired.
Really?
And I did not pass her. The pressure is enormous on faculty to pass students, especially students of color. And at this point, because I'm not affiliated with the university, I can be extremely candid about that.
So is there a double standard then? Just
absolutely. I believe there absolutely is. Both, look, in admissions, you well know that there are different standards of admission for students of color. Not Asians, but for especially for blacks, Latinos, and Native Americans. Mm-hmm. There have been many studies that come from, what is it called? Center for Equal Opportunity, Washington, D.C.
Right.
It shows a dramatic, dramatic difference in standards of admission for students of different races. Now, they say, we do it because we want to have more diversity in the classroom. Well, in the reality, there's as much diversity of ideology and thoughts. Two white people can come from completely different backgrounds, have completely different values. One could be liberal, one could be conservative.
Sure.
That diversity doesn't seem to count. And yet when it comes to melanin diversity,
yeah,
we're willing to admit students on grossly different standards.
Right. So at biological
Berkeley,
diversity.
The average SAT score, for example, of an African-American is about the 50th percentile. If you're white or Asian, you've got to be at about the average is about the 98th percentile. There is no question that there's a double standard in admission and in treatment. Look, in treatment of students, when I was a professor, because I wanted to be sure that I was not being racist, I always bent over backwards more mm-hmm. for minority kids, especially who were struggling, and disproportionately more minority kids were struggling. So there's even that kind of a quiet reverse discrimination. My minority kids got more attention from me, more support, more help. Mm-hmm. Than my white and Asian kids. And I refer to Asians not as a minority because it's different than the situation for blacks and Latinos.
Well, one of there's many arguments that have been put forth to justify these sort of preferences, and the diversity argument is sort of one of several, and we've picked that apart many times. Diversity for what purpose, for what sake, to what ends? That's one question in and of itself. Another aspect, though, they claim are historical injustices, as well as to try to get a traditionally, historically underrepresented section of our population to kind of be able to progress along economically and socially with the rest of society. And the way to do that is to give them access to education and opportunities such as college. Problem is
my most profound belief that we apply a different standard to a group of people because of their race.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, we serve not them nor society. We don't serve them because what happens is if we do use affirmative action to allow them into colleges where they're less likely to succeed, they're more likely to drop out. B, if they get through increasingly, as we pointed out, it's because of extra little favors, little quiet reverse discrimination. And then what happens is they get out in the workforce and they're not as good, and that what that does is it reinforces the very racism that we're trying to eradicate. I know there was the dean of the medical school at Harvard Medical School, the premier medical school in the country, Bernard Davis, who said to his wife, says, if I, God forbid, need surgery, and you see me being wheeled into the operating room, and there is a black surgeon, wheel me out. Now, that's an amazing statement, because remember, at Harvard, they can get anybody they want.
Mm-hmm.
And even at Harvard Medical School, this guy is so aware of the tremendous amount of reverse discrimination, not only in selecting the students, but in pushing them through, that he would not trust his own body to a black surgeon. That does not serve society. It does not serve minorities. Ultimately, you know, the arguments that it's not a level playing field, that they've had the legacy of discrimination and all of that stuff, that is way trumped by the negative effects of having different standards of admission and standards for getting through. Absolutely, from where I sit.
Well, that's obviously a very controversial statement by the dean. I've known many students of minorities who have managed to achieve very well, regardless of affirmative action. So would you say that the best way to apply diversity or to achieve diversity in institutions of higher education and in the workforce and among professional fields would be to raise the standards of education before college?
It starts at the very beginning. I really believe that it starts with excellent parenting education in the high schools, so that when people become parents, especially those in at-risk communities, they're likely to provide the good parenting from day one that will prepare them for school success and life success.
Mm-hmm.
It continues with you know, high quality, of course, preschools, etc. But then, especially when we get to the college level where the intellectual demands should be greater and not dumbed down, we have an obligation to society and to them to not shepherd them down paths where they're likely to fail. I am a terrible artist. If you told me, work hard, we'll let you into the art school, we'll give you support, we'll train you, yeah, we're going to take your $200,000, and you can be an artist, that would be malpractice, because I just don't have any ability in art. I am a stick figure drawer.
Mm-hmm.
It is similarly, there are some people who are not academically oriented, who just are not going to understand Shakespeare without downloading a term paper and substituting it. They're not going to understand Shakespeare. They're not going to understand stochastic processes in calculus and in chemistry. And to say, come right in, is in some ways like the Tuskegee experiments, where they took African Americans and did not and injected them with syphilis as in a part of an experimental drug treatment without disclosing what the odds are that it was going to work. And then, of course, many died. We are admitting hundreds of thousands of students a year, some white, of course, but disproportionately black and brown, who are grossly underprepared for college work. We're wrong even admitting them, but then we do not tell them how poor the odds of their graduation is. If a medical doctor prescribed a treatment that took 4 to 6 years, cost a fortune, without disclosing that the odds of it working were less than 1 in 5, and that the side effects are terrible, as in low self-esteem and huge debt, that doctor would be sued in every court in the land and win in every court in the land. And yet colleges, day in and day out, admit thousands of underprepared students without disclosing the likelihood of success or the negative side effects. And not only are they not excoriated, not only are they not sued, government increases the amount of financial aid that's given to students, which in turn merely allows colleges to raise their prices. It's a travesty.
You mentioned in your column, you made the analogy between what you're discussing now and Firestone tires. And
right.
You said that the government investigations, when they found them to be defective.
A small percentage of the Firestone tires to be defective. Yeah.
Right, right. And then they put all sorts of regulations to specify, and almost as if in a disclaimer, if you will, you know, what the treading is and what the conditions are and what the limitations are of the product. And then you wrote in your column here that you submit that the colleges should do the exact same thing. They should give the percentages of and the likelihoods of what graduation rates are, everything from your chances of getting a job to what you might learn, what you might not learn, and sort of openly disclose up front, if you will, before you start day one in college, what it is that you're getting into.
Absolutely. Look, if in fact, you know, every time you buy a tire, molded into that sidewall is a number that says it's tread life, it's traction, and it's temperature rating. If they do that for tires, should not for college, which costs a fortune, takes years of your life, and will profoundly affect it, should not each college be required to say, given your grades, your high school grades and SAT scores, here is the probability you will graduate. Here is the average amount of value added, how much you will, the average student with your high school grades and test scores, here is how much you will grow in writing, thinking skills, mathematical reasoning, etc. Here is what the likely financial aid package will be, given your family's income and assets, for not just the first year, but when in years 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, when typically, not typically, but very often, colleges will do what I call the drug dealer scam. They will give you a generous financial aid package the first year, a lot of cash and relatively small loan, and then in subsequent years, it gets worse and worse and worse and worse. Once they've gotten you hooked, they can jack up the price. Colleges should be required to report what is the likely financial aid in cash as well as loan that for a given, you know, this would be like a chart with the given a family's income and assets. That kind of full disclosure, and what kind of, you know, what percentage of students graduate in 4 years, what percentage of students graduate in 5 years, 6 years, and of those who graduate, what percentage of them within 6 months are holding a job that does indeed require a college degree, what percentage of them are holding a job that do not, like driving a cab, and what percentage are unemployed. Wouldn't that information be invaluable to prospective students in selecting a college? And wouldn't, if the bright light of that was shown on every college, wouldn't colleges then be forced to, instead of putting their money into shrubs, administration buildings, more funding for the Nittany Lion football team, and big administrative buildings and big administrative salaries, wouldn't they then feel forced to provide to spend more money on undergraduate education,
right,
instead of large lecture classes taught by research-obsessed professors? Perhaps intimate, small relationships with teaching-oriented, mentoring-oriented professors.
Right, exactly. Well, and just to clarify one point, though, in our case, the athletic department is the only one that is self-sufficient and that brings in a revenue stream. But nevertheless, your point stands about everything else that you're saying. except for maybe like big-time research grants that come into certain departments like applied research and things like that. But everything else, it seems like all resources are devoted to research, and the professors are, you know, it's publish or perish, as you know from being an academic.
Publish or perish. Yep.
Publish or perish. And you have to, you know, put out the research work and publish in scholarly journals. And as to how good of a teacher you are, there's no real rating for that other than these evaluations, which, you know, what do they mean when you hold them up to your published work? They don't mean very much, and the administration feels like they can get rid of get away with saving a lot of money by utilizing these grad students to teach these classes ever more so to undergrads, especially when they're remedial, and they don't have to utilize these high-salaried professors to do that. They can just do research
and
with them.
There are two other things there that are related. Sometimes, I don't know if they do it at Penn State, but they are now starting to use undergraduates to teach some classes at fellow undergraduates. Do they do that at Penn State?
There are, in fact, some undergraduate teaching assistants. That's correct. I don't believe they actually teach the courses, but they have taken the jobs that were formerly staffed by graduate students.
They're TAs.
Yeah. The other really, you know, the thing is not just in terms of the reward system for faculty, but it's the hiring system. We all know, you know, there are certain people who have the gift of teaching. There's the magic to inspire, to make complicated things seem clear. People who are fascinated with the idea of creating fantastic, exciting lessons. Well, the universities don't hire those people because the person who is going to put all of his passion and energy into that, normally there's a statistical term called orthogonal. It means they tend to be not inversely correlated with the kind of people who would get those research grants. Because research grants are usually about very narrow, technical, esoteric things that require deep, deep, deep knowledge. That kind of person who would be gravitating toward that is, in general, and there are exceptions, in general, the opposite of the kind of a person who would be that inspiring, brilliant, magical teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the biggest problem. It's who they hire.
Yeah, but there's also another part of this contract. The students themselves have to demand more. And like you said, there's that quiet, tacit agreement between parents and universities. There also seems to be this quiet, tacit agreement between students and faculty where, you know, I'll get by with the minimum requirements. You kind of give me the hint as to what you need to see on the test to get by, and I'll make your life easy, and you make my life easier, and you give me the B. I'll skate by with that, and we'll call it a day. We'll call it a semester, and you get paid, and I pay, and you get your salary, and I get my degree, my diploma, and then I go out and I get a wing special afterwards.
I don't blame the individual student because it takes so long to change a system. And they're so intimidated, you know, what 17 or 18 or 19-year-old is secure enough to go and challenge the great august professors, the great Penn State? So they're scared, first of all. And even if they're not scared, they say, Jesus, if I take this risk, I could really get in trouble. And there are very few people who are 17 or 19 or 21 years old who are brave enough to do that. They just say, oh, you're right, the system isn't that great. And in fact, what they do is psychologically rationalize, well, the system's really not bad. It's really me. I'm really dumb. I guess I'm not smart enough to get these brilliant, these professors are so brilliant. My God, they have PhDs. So they just, you know, quietly just go along. The reality is that the professors, you know, in some ways are emperors with no clothes.
Mm-hmm.
They're great at what they do. Their little narrow research area. And there are a few that are wonderful, inspiring teachers. But on average, the system is very, very rigged against the student.
It's interesting that you should bring that up because I actually have tried to challenge it as early as 17 when I first started here at Penn State. And I met with mixed reactions depending on the professor and depending on the administrator I approached. Some professors had the reverse reaction that to what you might have expected. They were actually glad. They were proud that a student would actually stand up and demand a more challenging, more rigorous course. And those were the two who spoke with me privately about how they were under pressure to dumb down their courses.
Yep.
But my larger question is then, of course, at that time, of course, I was only one man, but I'm sure many of our listeners would like to know, how can they change this? What can they do to affect a positive change?
What I really think the most important thing they can do. See, whenever you go to an individual professor or even to an administrator, they're going to yes you to death. Universities are very broad democracies. Among the faculty senate runs things. There are hundreds of faculty who have tremendous stakes in the status quo. You're never going to change it from within. I've tried for a million years. I'm not a young guy. I've been trying for a million years to change this system. It is incredibly hidebound. The only thing that they're scared of is two things: the alumni and the money of the donations, and the media. So if I were a 17 or a 19 or a 21-year-old who really wanted to change the system, I would make my point. I would assemble a group of undergraduate students who would be willing to speak very candidly with the media, and then I would contact the education and higher education reporters at the Philadelphia Inquirer, at the Associated Press, Justin Pope, at CNN, at Fox, you know, all the major. Now, again, I am not a conservative guy politically. I'm actually quite a moderate guy, registered Democrat. But I think, in general, the liberal media, because higher ed and the professors are generally quite liberal, the media has given a pass to higher ed because higher ed generally passes on liberal values to its students. Mm-hmm. So they're not too tough on it. So I think you're going to find greater success in going to the conservative media that is angry at colleges for a generally liberal bias in their classes. The places like Fox News or the Wall Street Journal, the National Review, might be more sympathetic to doing a big expose piece on higher ed. I think that's what's going to make the biggest difference. I think that protests at alumni events, big fat cat alumni events, the ones where they charge $250 a person to go and meet Joe Paterno, those kind of events are like, because that's going to hit colleges where it hurts, at the pocketbook. I also, right now, I don't remember if it's the Congress, the Senate, or the House, is considering a higher education reauthorization bill that is going to increase the amount of financial aid, which sounds so great, but all that's going to do is allow colleges to raise their prices more. They should be lobbying, actually going to Washington, D.C., and meeting with I happen to know the names of the senators who are on the committee reviewing this higher education authorization. They should be putting teeth into the bill, like what we've been talking about, where every college would be required to assess the value added and make public the value added that they provide to their students in writing, thinking skills, etc. That they need to be disclosing the 4-year, 5-year, 6-year graduation rates, the financial aid packages, how well they're employed afterwards. If your listeners to this show, the names of the people who are the senators are Mike Enzo, the senator from Wyoming.
Enzi, I believe.
Enzi, thank you. George Miller, the House of Representatives guy from California. Buck McKeon, M-C-K-E-O-N, also coincidentally from California. And Edward Kennedy, of course, who's unfortunately incapacitated. But Edward Kennedy's main staffer in charge of this is a guy named Carmel Martin. And Carmel Martin is the point guy. So if they really wanted to make a difference, they would go at it with the legislature, to the alumni, and with the media. That's how you get change. Not by going and talking to a professor, not by talking to the administrators, because they are the status quo. Mm-hmm. They have a great interest in making little minor incremental changes and in yes-butting you. And university administrators are very slick. They're really good at smiling and placating you and getting you to feel they're going to make a big difference. But, you know, I've been at this for 30 years. They are much better at smiling than they are about changing.
Very, very well put. And I was actually about to ask you, too, what sort of thing, can people do? And you kind of already answered it. But, you know, it's interesting, though, that there is no public outcry to any of this sort of thing. And if anything, when it comes to reforming universities, it seems as though the only sort of change that anybody calls for is for more public subsidy of the institution, which, as you said, only causes the price to just keep going up rather than keeping it down. And there's no outcry whatsoever from the public, and there's no accountability. There's no call for accountability, especially for public institutions or quasi-public institutions like Penn State. There just seems to be this rah-rah sort of, let's give them more subsidy and more help, because they're in education, and if it's education, it must be good.
Exactly, and that's for two reasons. The politicians know that it's like apple pie. Education, let's support education, let's provide financial aid. So they support it because the public says, oh, that's good. They don't realize that what they're essentially doing is taking taxpayer dollars and using it to subsidize colleges. It takes money from the middle class and taxpayer and puts it into the coffers of the colleges because the colleges can raise the tuition. But it doesn't sound like the public doesn't realize that. So the politicians realize they're going to get votes by supporting higher education, because if they don't support a higher education bill, their opponent is going to say, look, he's anti-education. So they're really, the politicians are between a rock and a hard place, and the media, who really have the power to educate the public, because, as I said, the media in general is so liberal, and they know that colleges generally have an enormous liberal bias. They are preparing the next generation of liberals. The colleges don't want to criticize, the media doesn't want to criticize the colleges. And so that's why, there's no press from either of them to reform higher ed. And right. The parents are too, and the kids are too intimidated in general. They just want, they either are too intimidated, or as they said, or they realize it's going to just take too long to try to make the change. Let me just get out and get on with my life. So there, as you say, there is no form, no pressure that comes from any organized group for improving higher ed.
One question I want to ask you here, and I don't know if you, how much you've looked into this, because I realize you're a career counselor, and I'm not sure how much you've looked into this, the economic aspect of all this. But I remember I read somewhere, it may have been in your column, that since the 1970s, the percentage of college tuition has gone up by such an astronomical amount. But there was another statistic here, and this was written by Ron Grossman, who wrote a column for the Chicago Tribune Review that appeared at the tail end of March. And I'm going to read you an interesting little excerpt to this, and this will really lift your eyebrows if you don't know about it already. He says, when I attended the University of Chicago in the 1950s, he says tuition was $600. He says, I worked part-time as a florist for $2.50 an hour. The relationship between the cost of college and what I earned kept me financially afloat. I graduated unencumbered by debt. He says, currently, however, the University of Chicago's tuition is $35,169, which is about 58 times what it was back in the 1950s. He says, florists, however, only make 4 to 8 times what he did back then. So the salary of the florist is 4 to 8 times greater. The cost of the college education is 58 times greater.
Well, and if the, you know, well, of course college will say, well, the costs of providing an education have greatly increased. Well, they're nowhere near, you know, as you well know, so much of instruction is still done as it was in the Roman times, in lecture classes, mm-hmm. which are not functionally that much more expensive. What's going on is the cost increases, partly the Robin Hood effect. Colleges are raising the sticker price so they can give the poor financial aid, so there's some of that. There's also a much bigger administrative bureaucracies. There's lobbying efforts. Believe me, higher ed couldn't be getting all this government funding unless they had big lobbyists, where they have a big bureaucracy, vice presidents who are, you know, in charge of legislative affairs. Mm-hmm. They, you know, part of it is also, I think, shallowness on the public. When kids now are college shopping, they expect shrubs and beautiful pools and student athletic centers, and they expect a country club, and that's part of the cost differential. I think that a really responsible college, I've actually written an article earlier in the Chronicle of Higher Education called Utopia College, in which I describe the ideal college, and it would be one that was very Spartan in terms of its the physical plant of the place, because it's, the cost of that is so enormous. The money should be spent on providing intimate relationships, and of course not sexual, between not only college and student, but student and student. We grow one-on-one. In Utopia College, there would be classes of size 5 or 10 that would not be even in campus buildings. They would be in the professors' homes. They would save a fortune on the cost of the buildings, etc., and provide the intimacy and openness that could only come. I remember being a graduate student at Berkeley and being very insecure. By the way, before I don't want people to think I'm just a career counselor. I have a PhD in evaluation of education from Berkeley. I subsequently taught in the graduate school. I've been a consultant to 15 college presidents. I've written 3 books on higher education. I was the senior author of the California accreditation procedures for high schools. I do need to establish a little credibility there. But in any case, when I was in graduate school at Berkeley, I was very insecure, and I would not do the one thing that would have been most important: to ask my dumb questions, to reveal my ignorance. That would have helped me grow. But because I was in not very large classes, but I was in a typical institutional environment, I was just scared to death. And so I just shut up, did what I took, and got my PhD. If I was developing these intimate relationships with professors by taking my classes in groups of 5 or 10 in their homes, and in more informal, where the professor was paid enough for the teaching effort that he didn't have to do a bunch of his ridiculously unimportant research that most professors do, but instead was developing mentoring relationships with me, I would have opened up, and I would have been more likely to grow and learn. And it is that, to me, that could make college affordable at the same time as you increase quality. We don't need fancy campus. I know the Penn State campus is beautiful. I know it feels good to walk around there if you're the prospective student checking out colleges. But the cost of it is just too great. We should put our money into the steak, not the sizzle.
Just before we run here, I want to ask you, are you familiar with the author Mark Bauerlein?
No, I'm not.
I don't know if I agree with everything that he writes here. He just published a book called The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future. And if you go to dumbestgeneration.com, you'll see it, and he's got that new book out. And I'll read a couple excerpts from his articles here. He says, the warning, the next generation might just be the biggest pile of idiots in U.S. history. Basically, if I can summarize it, he says that the digital age and all the quirkiness where people are constantly MySpace, Facebook, the text messaging, all the shorthand, the instant messaging, and everything else. They don't read any poetry. They don't know any literature. They don't know any world history. They don't know anything about world affairs other than the dumbed down stuff for the news junkies, which is all politically slanted. Basically saying that it seems as though no matter how tech savvy these people are, and I'll throw in the phrase Generation Y for a moment, it seems as though that they're really in a lot of ways dumber than people from decades ago, because they don't even know how to string together a coherent thought, a coherent sentence. They don't know how to write a paragraph or an essay, but they sure know how to do all this technical gadgetry. Other than that, they don't care about anything else that's going on in the world around them or how to interact in these intimate ways that you're describing.
I would not blame technology. I think having more ways to communicate and to provide profiles for yourself on Facebook and therefore connect with kindred spirits is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think technology like Google is amazing and wonderful. I even think that video games, not all of them, not just stupid shoot 'em ups, but that some video games actually will probably do more to facilitate the organizational and thinking skills than some of the classes that are taking in the college. So I'm not somebody who's going to blame technology. I just would, and I want to, since we're saying we're running out of time, I want to end on a very positive note. What can the listeners to this show do today as they're listening to improve their education? They're not going to leave Penn State. They're probably not going to protest. They're probably not going to go to the legislature. They're probably not going to go to the media. But what can you at least do to make the most of your time at Penn State? And so here I'm going to sound a little conventional, but that's okay. My job is not to always be unconventional. What I think you really need to do is to do your homework in really finding the best professors. I'm sure the evaluations of professors are available either online on the Penn State website or at the independent sites like studentsview.com. Find the best professors. If you can't get it that way, ask the administrative assistant at the department. They see all the student evaluations. Who would you recommend I take? Ask your friends. Ask your buddy. Take the best professors. Over-enroll. If you're planning on taking 5 courses, sign up for 6 and then go to the first class of each and drop the worst one. Be a great consumer in choosing your courses.
Mm-hmm.
Then number 2, do the best you can. Your growth will occur one-on-one. Find that unusually good and caring and wise professor. Develop a one-on-one relationship with them. Expose your weaknesses. Ask the questions. That's going to help you grow. With your fellow students, yes, stay up till 2 in the morning, not just getting drunk, but talking about the meaning of life, talking about world affairs, talking about the pros and cons of McCain versus Obama. If you've been hearing only liberal rhetoric, take that rare conservative course and learn about the conservative arguments that are legitimate. Yes, there's many legitimate arguments that are liberal, but there are also many legitimate arguments that are conservative. Make sure that your education really does give you the full education and full dimension of the wisdom that resides both left of center and right of center.
You mentioned the evaluations. Many students, unfortunately, you know, they themselves have to demand something better from the professors, and a lot of people fill out evaluations, I remember, based on whether the professor was hard or easy, and the easier the professor was, a lot of them filled out, oh, yeah, great evaluation, you know, because they didn't want to be challenged. They wanted to skate by.
Especially those independent websites that do rate professors, They ask you for separate ratings on how hard or easy versus how much you've grown from them or stuff like that. So, you know, there's no perfect answer. But I think too many people just randomly take the class that's most convenient. Shit, they say, geez, it's an 8 o'clock class in the morning. I'm not going to take that.
Right.
So really take seriously the idea of choosing your professors. It won't be perfect. You're never going to be perfect. But in balance, if you make the effort, your education is going to be better. But those three things, choosing the professors carefully, developing one-on-one relationships, whether it be with your RA, your fellow students, your professors, your advisors, whatever, that are good ones. If you don't have a good advisor, change. And then three, taking risks. Like, if you are a liberal, take a conservative course. If you're feeling insecure and feel dumb, ask about that question that you feel dumb about. Taking those kind of risks will result in you making the most of Penn State and then making it at least marginally worth your money and time.
Right, so get out of the comfort zone and challenge yourself.
I think so.
Right, right. Well, it's interesting because here we have all these resources devoted to support groups left, right, and center. Maybe left of center. And the mentality and the culture really is not to pull one out of their comfort zone, but rather to placate them and leave them in the comfort zone.
You're sounding awfully conservative for a guy in college. Is this the regular radio station, or is this an alternative conservative radio station?
We are the Penn State student radio station. I myself am a volunteer alumni advisor. I'm kind of past my days of being a student. John here is currently one of our student panelists, and he is actually part of the students for McCain here at Penn State campus. So he is kind of conservative, but. For the most part, though, we've been talking about these higher education-related issues for quite a long time, and everything that you're saying is stuff that we've covered many times before, and it's really refreshing to hear an authority speak on it because we've been kicking around these ideas for quite a while. The last question that I have for you, and I don't know how much of an economist you are, Marty, but with respect to the actual cost of college and how it's risen so virtually astronomically, as I alluded to earlier,
right.
Do you think there might be or that is there any artificial price inflation, sort of the way we saw that with CDs, and there was a class action lawsuit, you know, many years ago with CD sales having been marked up to costs that were far above what they should have been. Do you think that may be the same case with college tuition? And
well,
if there is, how do you find out?
Originally, I think it was a secret consortium among the Ivy League colleges that they were going to get together and share the financial aid packages that they gave to individual students with each other, that nobody ended up giving more to it was a tremendous restraint of free trade. I also know that there are some colleges who operate with the philosophy that, gee, if we raise our sticker price, it's going to make us seem like we're more elite. You know, there are fools in this world who pay more for something merely because it costs more. And so there's some of that going on. I'm not, going to say that there's major collusion. I think the biggest cause of higher education costs, ironically, is because the government continues to subsidize it, as much as they want, basically, both in terms of tax dollars, in terms of financial aid, and without regarding accountability. I think if the public was aware at how bogus the statistics are about, you earn $1 million more if you go to college, how absolutely misleading that is, and it's going to be ever more misleading, and if they were forced to show how little value added they provided, I think the demand for college would go down, and therefore the costs would go down.
Excellent. John, you got any other questions?
I believe you've covered everything. One more briefly. What can, our listeners do? We've already covered what they can do about increasing academic quality. What can they do now to lower cost?
Well, I really believe that most studies do not show any kind of causal relationship between the cost of college and the outcomes, whether in terms of learning or career. I would encourage people to take, if they're worried about money, to start at community colleges, which in general have better teaching than at the four-year schools, because professors aren't interested in research. That will save you a lot of money. See if you can either challenge courses with an individual professor and just take an exam, or using the CLEP exams. You can get college credit from those, high school students taking advanced placement classes. And I also think what's critical is to avoid changing majors. The conventional advice that you should dabble around for a couple of years and then choose is a mistake. What happens is you spend all this time dabbling, and the dabbling with professors doesn't necessarily make you clear about what the major should be. It's really a function of how lucky you were in getting a good professor for a particular introductory course. I encourage you to really take very seriously as a freshman, if possible, or as early as you can, the selection of a major. Read a lot about those majors in like my book, Cool Careers for Dummies, or in the Occupational Outlook Handbook, or there are many, or simply on the website, the Penn State website, detailed information about the majors. Be very, very careful. Look at the advanced courses in the major. Do it very, very carefully so that you don't change majors and then happen to be on the six-year plan for graduation.
Okay, very good. Marty, do you have a website out there?
I sure do, with 500 of my published articles there, including the one that we've been talking about, America's Most Overrated Product, the bachelor's degree. But it's all free. Plus, I host a show on National Public Radio in San Francisco. All my shows for the last 3 years are there, all free, downloadable MP3s, you know. So it's the web address is martynemco.com, which is spelled M-A-R-T-Y, N like Nancy, E-M like Mary, K-O.com.
Okay, very good. We'll check that out. Encourage everyone to see that website and see all of your books and your articles. Again, your most recent one, America's Most Overrated Product, the Bachelor's Degree, appeared on the May 2nd issue of the Chronicle of Higher Education. Okay, Marty, we thank you again. You're a career counselor based out of Oakland, California, and we thank you kindly for taking an hour of your time today to speak with us today on the Line 90.7 FM, Penn State Student Radio.
I'm just terrified that some professor or administrator is going to hear this and going to give me hell.
Not, it wouldn't be the first time, right?
Yeah, it's true. I just don't want them to think I'm just some career counselor. I've really, you know, I really do have a PhD from Berkeley in evaluation of education. I really have been a consultant to 15 college presidents. I know what I'm talking about.
All right. Excellent. Thank you.
Take care.